everyone. Welcome to this special edition of the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For you, it is January 18th. But for Jack and I, we are filming on Thursday, January 14th. We're doing this because Monday is Martin Luther King Jr. Day here in the U.S., and that means markets are closed as well as the Real Vision offices. This AMA is a little different. Normally, we have somebody more senior like Raul or Ed here to answer your questions, but Jack and I are the young bucks, and we have a different perspective on markets. So we are going to bring that perspective to you today, and I'm excited to hear from Jack and selfishly to share a little bit of my own perspective because I generally do hold back a little bit. And so I want to skip the niceties and get right into the questions. Jack, we have a question from Pavel, which says, could you two speak a little bit about your careers up until the point you joined RV? I believe neither of you have a traditional finance background, but are clearly up to speed. How did you make the transition and what did you do to catch up so fast?
Thanks, Max. It's great to be here. I think we got so many questions from the Real Vision Exchange. It's always great when you have an AMA and you get just such a flood of questions. So let's get right into it with Pavel's question. So I had a variety of internships in college. Probably the most notable one would be at a startup that was in the travel sector, which is obviously not so good of a sector right now with COVID. But it was called Rallybus. And it was crowdsourcing demand for buses. So we actually had a lot of business going to sort of protests and all sorts of things. So it's like, oh, you're meeting the same types of people who want to go to a Phish concert, let's say. They tend to be the same sorts of people. So they'd get along on a bus. That was sort of the idea. And that was exciting. I also interned at Bloomberg, where I was on the research and strategy team working on a variety of projects, such as like the user function on Bloomberg, where when you log into Bloomberg, depending on which role you're in, like you're on the equity sell side, or you're on the bond buy side, you have different functions that sort of come up. So that was one of the projects I worked on. And so I became very familiar with the terminal. And Max, when I was looking for a full-time job at Real Vision, that was, you remember, that was one of the skills that you were looking for, was someone who knows how to use Bloomberg in order to make charts. So despite the fact that I knew how to use Bloomberg, I would say that I still had so much to learn, starting up from day one at Real Vision. And it really was starting at Real Vision when I'd say my education in full began. And I'd say I've learned a tremendous amount from the contributors as well as the people who work here. So that's my story. Max, what about you?
Yeah, so mine is similar, a little different. I'm a few years older than Jack. Jack actually, he didn't mention it, but this was his first full-time job. That's why all of the experience he listed before were internships. So we luckily plucked Jack right out of Brown. But I'm 2 years older, and I happen to have one job before Real Vision. I worked at an insurance company. It wasn't exactly, the perfect job in the world. And I thought maybe I could work my way into the bond department and get to learn some bond math there. And, insurance companies are rather limited in what they can do. But it's still a way to get your hands on a big pool of money and learn from some skilled people. Well, that didn't end up working out, and I got an opportunity to come here and work at Real Vision. But before that, I was a subscriber to Real Vision, and that was a huge part of my financial education, was watching Real Vision. That really started in college. I was a physics major at Ohio State who realized very quickly I was not going to advance the field, most likely. And if I did make it through and get my PhD, I'd probably be teaching freshmen at some podunk university in the middle of nowhere. And so I had to do something else with my life. And I didn't want to start over in school. I wanted to finish my physics degree. And I started, this was like 2015, 2016, 2017. I started learning about finance. And I had always been tangentially interested in it because, my dad worked in finance. And so I learned a lot from him, and he has been a big mentor to me and has taught me a lot. And he was actually a Real Vision subscriber, and he sent me some Real Vision videos and other podcasts around like Macro Voices, Capital Allocators with Ted Seides, the Investing Podcast. And that's really just like the tip. It's great to watch and listen to content, but what I would do is I would watch a video And then I would go read about the things I didn't know in the video. And then I go watch it again. And, you know, that process, you iterate it over and over and over again until now I can watch a video at 2x speed and really retain a lot of the information. So it just comes from exposing yourself, going the extra mile to go in and learn things yourself. And, you know, a lot of people say that curiosity is key in, you know, getting better at any sort of endeavor.
Right. So Max, you know, and Jeff Gundlach, when he describes his journey in finance, he was in a rock band and then he joined a bond investment firm. He says, yeah, you know, within the first week, I realized that I knew more and I was smarter than everyone who I was working with. Within 6 months, I was running a $100 billion portfolio. Within a year, I was in charge of all bond offers. So you basically thought that your journey in insurance would be like that with Jeff Gundlach, but then you realize, oh, maybe so much not. So then you worked at Real Vision and, you know, you can have a much greater impact. So it's glad that we have you here at Real Vision.
Yeah, let's just say I was in the wrong department there, and it just wasn't a good fit. But yeah, I mean, Real Vision has been great. I don't manage any money except for my own. And that's one of my favorite things is if you work, say, on a desk or at a hedge fund, you really can't trade your own account in a lot of ways. There's compliance and rules around that. But here at Real Vision, we get to invest our own money and do that. And I feel it's really nice to have skin in the game and, you know, and to learn. And you learn a lot that way, too. And you know, I'm fortunate, especially in a time like this, to have a job where I have income that allows me to take risk. But yeah, taking losses, taking risk, and learning while at the same time still being humble and understanding that even when you're right or a trade works out, that it can be luck. Doing a lot of postmortem of your investment ideas and your trades, both the ones that work and the ones that don't work, still helps. And this is still very much the beginning of my journey. Still have a lot to learn. I don't think I'm even close to the end. But I wanted to move on to another question here. Similar question about how we've evolved. And Ross wants to know, how has your viewpoint on cryptocurrencies evolved over time?
That's a good question. So the first financial article that I wrote was for an investment publication at Brown, and it was about crypto. And I published it in early 2018, and it was about crypto had exploded. I think, you know, Bitcoin was probably about $15,000 then. And I called into question the valuation metrics of how you value crypto. And it was basically, it was, for lack of a better word, a hit piece on crypto. And my timing could not have been better. Obviously, that, you know, crypto, the bubble sort of popped in 2018. So I started off being very, not very, but, you know, somewhat skeptical of Bitcoin, excuse me, of crypto. I'd say as I've learned more about it, I've gotten a little bit more of a nuanced view. And you talk about luck. I think, I called it on Bitcoin. I think I really just got lucky with the timing. But yeah, now my opinion on crypto is that Bitcoin deserves or may deserve a small, but nevertheless, existent part in a portfolio. I think it does offer a favorable risk reward. I'm not saying it's a sound investment, but I think it's a good trade. What do you think, Max? What has your evolution been on crypto?
Well, I actually started out as somebody who, you know, when I was younger, I had a sort of libertarian leaning to me, and I knew people who were, learning about the dark web in high school, and, you know, they showed me Bitcoin, and, you know, I have a friend who lost his key from Bitcoin he owned back in 2012, who would be, you know, a multimillionaire today from, you know, the change on a transaction that he made. You know, just the change coming back to him, the number of Bitcoin would be worth so much today. And so, you know, that was really when I first heard about it. And I just thought it was like internet money used for the dark web and for, you know, things like the Silk Road. And I didn't really think about it for a while. And then, you know, it started to move a little bit. People started talking about it, and I was actually, you know, very, very bullish on it. But then, you know, I started to learn more, and I actually became like a little bit more skeptical, partially because, you know, the use cases when I started out learning about it were about, you know, transactions and it's going to be the digital dollar and all that. And, you know, that really shifted. And when in a company, for instance, when a business, like their use case is always shifting or, you know, the story is always different, like in a gold mine, like it's the same drilling results, but it's a different story every time about like why the drilling results are good. Like that's not a good sign. And so that made me more skeptical. But nothing changes sentiment like price. So, and that obviously, 2017, I really, you know, kind of missed that one. And so I started paying attention to it and I participated a little bit in this last run and at different points in time, it's gotten up to be a higher percentage of my portfolio really than any other holding. But it doesn't, I'm not irresponsibly long, perhaps to my own detriment, where we will find out. And then as far as like altcoins and stuff like that go, like here at Real Vision, we have to be generalists. We really do. We cover so much. We cover so many different markets. And I mean, it's really complex and there's a lot of different stuff going on in there. And so I actually am less skeptical of the DeFi blockchain-based technology. Like I think that there are plenty of use cases for that, but like I just don't have the time to dive in and do the due diligence that I need to do to really, you know, go all in on a specific altcoin or technology like that. So, you know, it doesn't make up a part of my portfolio. Again, probably potentially to my own detriment. But that's kind of where I stand. You know, I do think that there is a semi-religious aspect to the way a lot of people feel about Bitcoin. Like that makes me uncomfortable. It makes me nervous. Like they could be right, but I don't really like that too much. It makes me uncomfortable.
Right. Max, just going back to what you said about the shift in the use cases, the shift of the narrative, were you referring to the fact that say in 2012, 2013, early on, and in the Satoshi Nakamoto white paper, that person promulgated Bitcoin as a means of exchange, as this is going to be a digital dollar, a way to buy things so that you don't have to rely on Visa and MasterCard and the Federal Reserve. Whereas now the narrative is not so much it's going to be a means of exchange, but rather it's a store of value. It's a leverage play on central bank balance sheet. In other words, it's an investment. It's not a currency. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah. And in some ways, like store, like what does that mean to be a store of value? Like I think many people like look at the rhetoric. It's, you know, have fun staying poor. Like that's not what people say about stores of value. That's what people say about get rich quick schemes. And so like even that, it's less of a store of, you know, it's an uncorrelated asset and it is relatively uncorrelated. So I'm not going to lambast that. And as well, you know, the sort of like Mark Yusko, like get off zero is like the best decision an allocator can make. Like so far, like that has proven true.
Real quick before we move on is I'd say, yeah, both of us are hashtag responsibly long, perhaps. And I also would say that just on my own belief, I think that Rao's theory, hypothesis on the wall of money, institutional money coming for crypto from so many, a variety of sources, and the only way that they can buy it is through the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, which has a limited amount. I think that is a very compelling argument, and so far it's proven to be true. Now, that's like the soft case for Bitcoin. The hard case for Bitcoin, that it's going to become a global reserve asset that's going to replace gold and perhaps even the dollar. That is something that I think, while possible, the likelihood is much, much more slim. Yet the upside, you know, for that would be so tremendous that it still has a favorable risk reward profile. So that's my thought.
Yeah, I'm much more in line with the wall of money than I am the future of currency. Yeah. Let's move back to traditional finance a little bit. Jorge Rodriguez says bond investing is very complicated. Guess on RVDB, I'm guessing Real Vision in general, tend to throw around terms, assuming the audience is familiar with how everything works, but I don't. So can you explain from the basic principles, the relationships between things like bond prices, bond yields, real bond yields, Fed interest rate, a bond's coupon rate, inflation, the dollar, equities, how and why changes in one invoke changes in the other. So unfortunately, we won't be able to get to all of that. But if you could just give, you know, a little rundown for Jorge on, you know, how bond prices, yields, and real yields and relate to things like, you know, the Fed funds target rate and coupon, things like that.
Yeah, well, Max, despite the fact that I studied economics in college, I wouldn't say that I fully understood this and really, you know, comprehended the nuances until I started working at Real Vision and listened to some of the folks that probably Jorge is referring to, as well as specifically you, Max, explain this to me in a way that sort of made me fully get it. So I'm going to turn this back on you and say, can you answer Jorge's question? Since for me, you've given me that clarity.
Okay, well, let's start with, you know, the Fed's rate. So the Fed sets interest rates. It's like the risk-free short-term rate, and then all rates go off of that. And, you know, traditionally, what you could think of is the amount of risk in the investment. If you assume that a short-term bond from the U.S. government has the least amount of default risk in the world, like that should be like the lowest interest rate upon which all other interest rates are based. And then from there, like you take more duration risk. So that's uncertainty about where interest rates will be. As you go further out on the spectrum of duration in bonds, you generally would get more, more yield on that. And so that's how duration can affect things. And that's duration risk. But then there's solvency risk, which is when you start to get into like corporate credit, other sovereign debt in the world. And so, you know, it makes sense that a corporation is probably less likely to pay you back than a government that can print its own money. And so for that reason, corporate credit traditionally pays a little bit higher than that rate. And the rate that is set when a bond is issued is the coupon. So there's an initial price. Let's just for our sake, you know, it's generally called par. And that's like, let's say it's $100. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's say it's got a 2% coupon. So, you know, there's $2 being paid out. Well, if somebody goes and says, you know, I think interest rates are going down and they're willing to pay $101 for that, well, you're still going to get the same $2 payment, but you paid $101. And so it's not yielding 2%. And so that's how yields go. And then yields go up, say when a bond gets paid $99 instead of $100, then the yield has gone up. And so that's how prices and yields have that inverse relationship. Well, then it relates to inflation too, because if you're getting 2% and inflation is at 3%, then you're actually getting a negative real return in your purchasing power. And so you have a negative 1% real yield on that 2% yielding bond. And so that's how inflation plays in. And basically it relates to the dollar and other currencies in the world because rates can be attractive, like the relative rate. So, you know, rates are negative in Europe, well, as they're still slightly positive here. If you are a big, let's say like an insurance company, a lot of them have specific rules about what they can own and the types of bonds they can own. And, you know, if you have a limited pool of places that you can put your capital, you're going to want to go to the most attractive place. And that demand creates demand for the currency. And so it can play out in the dollar, the differences between rates. And obviously, you know, this is what I'm talking about is theoretical, because you have some interesting stuff like, I think Greece yields less than the U.S. government bond. And like Greece basically had a debt crisis less than 10 years ago. I don't think anybody would say that Greece is more likely to pay back their debt than the United States at this point in time. But still, here we are, and their bonds yield less than U.S. bonds. So, you know, what I said about the risk, it differs, and there are other forces in play. But, you know, really simply, that's how I think about bonds. And then it is very complicated. Every single thing that I have learned about finance has opened up a completely new world above it. And as you learn more, the more you realize that it's nuanced. And so when people try and explain things as being very simple or very easy, like that's generally a red flag for me. Like a sign of true expertise in a field is generally the answer, well, it's complicated, or there's nuance to it. Like that's a real honest answer. And it's tough because it's the trade-off between conviction, which really helps you feel confident in something new that you're learning, and true understanding. And sometimes those are in conflict. And sometimes to have confidence, you have to ignore the fact that you don't understand something perfectly. So that's something that I think anybody who's learning about this will have to grapple with over time, that conflict between conviction and true understanding.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I think that's right. And I think that what you just said, you gave a pretty simple understanding. And that is really important to someone like Jorge, who's just looking to build a framework. Like, I might want to add some complexity and say, talk about interest rate parity and the reason that different interest rates, you know, around the world exist, or that their interest rate differentials is because of inflation expectations and the expected return of assets denominated in those assets. I might also talk about how, you know, the reason that yields in Greece are negative is because there are certain rules, as you mentioned, that European banks have to own government bonds. So it's not so much a free market. It's more rules-based. But so I think that's adding a few layers of complexity, but I think it is important to sort of break things down sometimes just so you don't, you know, people don't get lost.
Yeah. And you start at that basic framework, and then from there you recognize the discrepancies. And then you have to go learn about it. And it's kind of like chemistry, like the periodic table, like learning chemistry, I call it the science of exceptions. Like, there's all of these great rules, and if everything followed the rules, then it would be a very simple science. And you could just go down the periodic table, everything would work, but then there are all these exceptions along the way. And like, that's what really differentiates a true understanding. And I think finance is like that too. Like, there are these rules that come down, but as you move through it, as you move through the science, you start to figure out, like, there are so many exceptions. And that's where you really start to learn about, you know, the plumbing. So I want to move on, though, to a question here that I think we're both going to give short answers on, but interesting nonetheless. Matthew Lansing wants to know, I would love for someone to speculate on the Chinese banks, the PRC, Jack Ma demonstration, and the timing of all of this stuff around Ant Financial.
I don't have a ton to say about that. I'm not super plugged into that world, but I guess I can recommend a few videos. I'd watch some Kyle Bass interviews. I think he did a great job with Steve Clapham, which aired sometime in November of last year, where this is before people, this is before Jack Ma went missing, or people realized that he went missing. And he talks about the various investment risks that foreign investors in China are taking, and perhaps they don't realize that they're taking. So I don't have a ton more to say about that. Max, what's your take on it?
I mean, it's just like a confirmation of trend. I think, you know, there was a belief in the early 2000s that China was becoming more like us, and then that sort of reversed, and we've been on a trend of increased party control, and this is just another checkbox that says that trend is still firmly in place. You know, what it means, the implications going further, you know, I'm not the right person to answer that, but it's certainly another data point, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's go on to the next question, Max. Brian Barry asks, the various interviews and podcasts I've seen say QE is not inflationary despite M2, that's the monetary base, going way up, because when a bank buys and sells new treasury bonds to the Fed, the newly created money goes into the bank's excess reserves at the Fed. I'm just wondering, where does the money come from the bank, from the private bank, to buy the treasury bills? Won't that be inflationary, as that money will finally get used and out into the monetary system? So just a pretty broad but detailed question about QE and the impact of QE on inflation or deflation.
Well, so I would say that the main argument for QE not being inflationary is the lack of inflation we've seen since QE has been rolled out. And it's been rolled out all over the world in many different forms. Different forms in you know, Japan, they just straight up buy the index through ETFs. We buy bonds here in the US, and it hasn't really, we haven't seen inflation. So I think that that is really the best argument against it. There are better, you know, economists and people who work at the treasury departments of big banks who could better explain the mechanics behind it. But one of the things I noticed in that question was he said, like, where do they get the money to buy the bonds to then sell them back? Like, it's not like a quick trade for them. I think these are bonds that they already own that they're selling back. Like, they're not buying them to sell them back. These are bonds that are already on the balance sheets of the banks. So I think that was one of the things that I feel confident of saying, you know, is maybe a little bit of a misunderstanding from Brian. These are bonds that the banks already own that they're selling back to the Treasury, or to the Fed, and the Fed is creating liquidity. So, you know, the banks wanting to get these off their balance sheet, if there's no liquidity and they have to, you know, give up a few basis points here and there to get these things, to get the cash that they want, like that affects the health of the banks. And I think, you know, that's what they're trying to avoid is that sort of bleed caused by illiquidity. And so that's why they're doing what they're doing to help the banks be able to maintain seamless operation. Things that they would be trying to get rid of anyway.
Yeah, I think the relationship between QE and inflation is a puzzling one. I'd say the mainstream economic view is still tilted towards it being slightly inflationary, but people who are saying that it's deflationary, it's not. It's in the minority, but it's not a fringe belief by any means. I think the economists who say that it is inflationary, I mean, it just makes sense. The more money that you print, again, I'm using that word because it's not printing, it's reserves, but the more, you know, money that you create, that will cause inflation. But you know, monetary velocity, the velocity of money has decreased as that money has had a very hard time getting into the real economy. So it's very nuanced. You know, quantitative easing, it's technically just the increase. You know, the Federal Reserve has been buying and selling different tenors or different maturities on the yield curve via Operation Twist since at least 1961. But the real quantitative easing is that it's not buying and selling, it's just buying. So it's a very nuanced idea. I would recommend to Brian to watch some interviews with Lacey Hunt, as well as so Lacey Hunt, more the traditional monetarist view. And then if you want the more minority view, I'd watch Stephen Van Meter's interview with Brent Johnson.
Okay. All right. I'm moving on to the next question here. Chris Bannock says, I'm just learning about cycles and I'm wondering how reliable they are to use to make forecasts. I've heard some people making amazing forecasts in the future for them, but it seems more of an art than a science. Any recommendations for implementing them with trading at all?
Right. Cycles are so important, and there are certain investors who say, you know, cycles are not relevant. It's all about focusing on the fundamentals, but Howard Marks believes in cycles. Warren Buffett believes in cycles, although he wouldn't say it in an interview, but if you look at his track record, you know, he invested in Japan in 2011, you know, right as, you know, the cycle was leading you to invest in that way. So I think cycles are tremendously important. I don't have a recommendation for implementing them with trading other than make sure you spend enough time doing your research to make sure that it's not a false signal. Max, what are your thoughts on this?
I think his characterization of more art than science is very accurate. Cycles happen, but they're not, it's not like clockwork. You know, things can, we talk about like the 10-year expansion, like we've had expansions that are 5 years. The one that we just had was, assuming that COVID marks the end of the expansion, was the longest in history. And so, you know, that's a pretty big gap there. And if you are just taking the mean of like 7 years or something like that, like you're going to be early sometimes and late sometimes. So you have to be nuanced in your view. And again, it's a data point. It's the preponderance of the evidence, like everything together. And so it's just another factor that you add in. You still maybe, if you want to invest in a cyclical industry, you want to make sure that it's the right time in the cycle. But that doesn't mean you just throw darts at the board and pick anything in that industry. You still want to do your fundamental research. You still want to find the ones that technically their charts look good for entry. And you add up all of those things. And that's how I would implement it into my trading. It's a data point. Everything is to be layered on top of each other.
That's so true. I think if you look at the ratio of the Bloomberg Commodity Index to the S&P 500, it is at a low that has not been seen since 2000, indicating that, you know, and 2008 was an extremely good time to go into commodities. So the cycle is on your side, but that doesn't mean that the cycle will get even worse before there's a reversal. You know, if there's sort of a doom loop scenario over the next 4 years where there's, you know, mass deflation and solvency, that obviously is not going to be good for commodities. So you have to manage your risk. And as you said, not throw darts at the board. But I want to go into Andrew Harms, who asks, I hope this is a fun one. When I used to work on the sell side, we occasionally bantered. If you were to win the lottery, to whom, as in portfolio manager investors, would you give your winnings to manage and why? So I want to ask you, to which of the RV contributors would you give your winnings to manage and why?
That would be great to win the lottery. I would say that depends on like what type of person you are and how much of the lottery you win. So I know this maybe isn't the answer that Andrew is looking for. He wants me to tell him my favorite portfolio managers. And it all depends on the strategy. And, you know, a lot of people allocate to different managers to construct sort of a portfolio for themselves made up of different managers. If you take $10 million and you can generate like a 5% interest rate, like you're making 500 grand a year. Like that's enough for me. I can live off of that. So, you know, some people, they want to compound. They like want to become a billionaire and do all of that and change the world. Like that's not, I don't need that. So, you know, I would probably look for somebody who can generate me some nice income. If let's say I have that like $10 million amount, but if you're looking for somebody to like compound your money, you want to go with the best people with the best track record. You know, people comment all the time, like, man, those fees are really high. And I've heard some people say you either want to pay the least fees or the highest fees. Like the middle ground is not where you want to be. People who need to lower their fee by like a quarter of a percent to like get your allocation, like maybe you shouldn't be allocating to them anyway. The best investors can charge the highest fees because they beat the market. So, that's something that is interesting. To give a few names, to some of my favorites, and obviously I tend to interview the people who I really like. Matt Rao is one of the best long volatility portfolio managers out there. He won the EQ Derivatives Manager of the Year in 2019. I'm not sure about 2020. Having just talked to him about his returns in the year he had, you know, he really did have a fantastic year. You've got to have some real money to be able to invest in a lot of these guys. Like, it's not something where you can go and give them 50 grand, 100 grand. Like a lot of these people have like minimum $1 million investments. So if that's not you, I wouldn't go calling any of them up. What is his name? Jeff Myers of Cobia Capital has a really interesting approach to investing in small cap technology. And you know, I've seen his returns and we talk about, you know, the companies he's invested in. He's had a fantastic year, but in a world where both small caps and value have underperformed, he's beaten the market since he launched his fund back in 2008 and with an incredible sharp ratio. And so, you know, it's not the type of place where you could put $1 billion to work. I don't think the strategy would, you know, maybe work at that level. But, you know, if you've got a small amount of money to put together, I think Jeff is a great steward of capital, but not investment advice. I will caveat, not investment.
Yeah.
Jack, do you have anybody or do you want to move on?
Yeah, I got a few ideas. So first, I'd say that I want to allocate money to people who can do things that I can't do. So for, you know, I'm allocating to a hedge fund manager who's going to charge me 2 and 20 for investing in Facebook and Google and Amazon. I'm not so keen. I think I'll just buy that myself. But you know, distressed debt investing, I think Howard Marks, his ability to generate alpha relative to anything I could do is tremendous. So I'll allocate to him. In terms of the long volatility world, you know, obviously there are experts in that. Mike Green, Matt Rao, as you said. Also, Jason Buck has a fund of funds for volatility. So maybe if I didn't win the Powerball lottery, I won more of a lower ticket amount, I'd probably go with the
Rhode Island fund. State Lottery or something.
Exactly, the Rhode Island State Lottery. Who else? Andrew McDermott, you invest in Japan. Any other investors who are in emerging markets? I'd also probably have a little baseline in securitized credit, and that's not a field I'm familiar with. So, you know, maybe Joshua Friedman of Canyon Partners, Canyon Capital. So yeah, a lot of names come to mind. That those are just a few.
Okay. Okay. So this is a question. This is a question that I want to address, and I'm not going to let you answer it. But Jason Markow wants to ask about taxation strategies for crypto. We're not tax advisors. We will never be tax advisors, and we cannot give tax advice. If you have questions about taxes, we recommend that you talk to an accountant and a licensed tax advisor in whatever jurisdiction you may be in. And that is all I will say about that question. Yeah. Okay. So John says, Jack and Max, you've been able to get direct exposure to some of the world's greatest financial minds here at Real Vision. How has this changed your own personal investment strategies, and who has influenced you the most?
That is such a good question. Max, do you want it? Do you want to take it?
I mean, who has influenced me the most? I mean, it's hard to say. There are a lot of people. Look, I came into Real Vision as kind of like a Fed basher. I mean, I would say that is one of the things that has changed the most for me. Like, I used to, when I started at Real Vision, I didn't have any money invested in the market because I was like, it's all overvalued. Like, you know, this whole thing is going to come tumbling down. And, you know, as time has gone on and I've worked here, you know, that has certainly changed. I don't think there's one person who's directly responsible for like, for that sort of thing. I mean, if there is one thing that I think I have clung to, it's some of the stuff around, you know, Mike Green and passive, and like, who is the marginal buyer going to be, and the importance of flows. You know, that is something that I think is very important. And that has definitely been, that wasn't something that I thought about too much before I joined Real Vision. But I mean, it's really, again, it's the preponderance of all the evidence. Like, it all adds up over time, and you take little tidbits, and you know, you don't agree with everybody. But it really works out. And it's the same thing in, you know, they say, like, if you take the average of all of the guesses on the jelly bean jar, like how many jelly beans are in the jar, like, it's way better. It's extremely accurate. And so I think, you know, that Real Vision, because we get so many views, I talk to people who are in all different fields, that it's getting to hear all of that and kind of being the mean of all of those ideas, I think has been hugely beneficial.
Definitely. For Mike Green has certainly influenced my thinking. I'd also add Jim Chanos, Jim Grant, and those are in terms of specifically actionable advice. I'd also include Raul and Julian in shaping my macro framework, and just how not in terms of specific trades, but how I sort of think about the market. And certainly to respond to the Federal Reserve as an action that impacts you know, asset markets, rather than sort of just bashing it and then getting mad when my, you know, your shorts didn't work out, as you said before you joined Real Vision. So for example, you know, if Julian says, oh, I'm a believer in reflation and I'm going to buy corn or something, a corn future, I may not buy that corn future because that's not within, you know, my own remit that I've assigned myself. But I think I'm thinking, okay, reflation, you know, commodities, emerging markets, and then obviously rally on Bitcoin. So yeah, I'd say those names.
Yeah, and there's definitely. I don't think either of us would be here if it wasn't for Rao and Grant, and you know, a lot of the work that they did sort of before we got here. So obviously, those two both had a tremendous influence on me, and you know, I felt that one was a bit obvious, so I didn't.
Yeah.
But yes, we can kiss the ring a little. Let's see. Let's move on. We are kind of running down towards the end here, so I want to be a little bit more choosy in these questions. Here's a good one from Stephen Pickering. So Rao mentioned this week that he will rotate out of BTC at the high and move into EMs. Can he explain further, as I thought his BTC was a forever trade to protect his assets?
I didn't see that question.
Okay. Also, I'll take it, which is, look, Rao will sell any investment that he thinks is right to sell, and he believes in emerging markets, and he has in previous I haven't kept up with the insider talks over the last few months, but you know, he a few months back, I think the quote was, there will be a time when you buy EM and go to the beach, because like it has lagged so much, like it has been undervalued, it just has been ignored, and there will be a point in the cycle when it's just that easy, and maybe there is you can just throw darts at a dartboard and hit and get great returns. So you know, I think he really does believe that, and I don't think anything is a forever trade to Rao. I don't like to speak for people too much, but I feel confident in that he doesn't really believe in anything being forever.
Yeah, I also don't want to speak for Rao, but I to feel confident that if he thinks something is a good trade, he's going to recommend it and do it himself. I think in his RVDB with Ash about a week ago, last Friday, he said he has his eye on Eurodollar calls, or for more retail investors, calls on TLT, you know, long-term bonds, because he thinks interest rates are going to decline. Maybe some S&P 500 puts, and then he's not a believer in the reflation trade, but if it does come down the road, as you said, buy emerging markets and just relax on the beach. I know he's particularly bullish on India.
Yeah. I mean, as we're sitting here today, a piece came out where Rao interviewed an investor on Iran. I know he's extremely bullish on that Middle East region, and he likes Iran. I believe he's also talked about Iraq before. Obviously, I think he calls it sort of like the monsoon region in India, so that encompasses other countries in that sort of geographic area. But it's partially because he believes in the importance of demographics. That demographics drive growth, and a lot of the West, China, Japan, we have upside down demographic pyramids, and that there are some areas like Africa and the monsoon region that have this other have more favorable demographics. And you know, there are arguments that refute that say, you know, that they're not going to be able to have the same sort of like manufacturing boom that helped us build our consumer economy, that built out a middle class. And because we're sort of maybe past that and moving towards a period of automation, that there are some risks. So, you know, everything, there is another side to every trade. Like if there wasn't an argument against it, like what markets would be priced perfectly, and there'd be nice flat lines of asset prices until events happen. But that's not how it works. And it's because people have differing ideas and differing time horizons. That's what makes markets.
Absolutely. Max, because we have limited time left, I'm going to appoint myself as the captain of this interview from here on out. I'm going to ask all the questions, and it's going to be a lightning round. So Baldi asks, hi, gents. New to Real Vision, only recently joined, would be interested to hear your thoughts on Coinbase IPO and how, if smaller investors will be able to look in. I'm going to answer that very shortly. Again, not investment advice. This is my own personal opinion. I think that crypto is an extremely volatile and highly speculative area. So, you know, owning sort of crypto is sort of like owning, or investing in a gold or in a gold miner, whereas owning Coinbase IPO, whether crypto goes up or down, is kind of like selling shovels outside. So I do like the idea of owning Coinbase IPO. Obviously, everything is relative to valuation. So that's my own take. Moving on. Kevin Siorka asks, and this is for Max, what is driving the increasing 10-year treasury yield in the U.S.? Are yields rising because of an optimistic outlook on future growth, government deficits, or some other reason? Max, your thoughts in a minute or less.
I mean, certainly the rise in 10-year treasury yields has coincided with Joe Biden winning the presidency, and there's been even more rise in yields after the blue wave was sort of completed with the Senate. So, you know, that is a decent argument, but I mean, there's always stuff going on beneath the surface as to why it happens. And so I don't like to speculate too much on what is driving yields at this point. I think, you know, just based off of what it coincided with, I think that's a fair point to take. But, you know, there are big boys who move markets, and their reasons, unfortunately, I'm not privy to.
Certainly. I think the easy narrative that just smacks you in the face is that Biden is elected. He's going to pass a stimulus bill, which is going to be reflationary. So you want to own equities, you want to go risk on, own cyclical sort of value stocks, and rotate out of the safe assets such as bonds. And that is what investors have done. What I can say with a reasonable amount of confidence is that it's not the Fed who has stopped buying. They have made committed. They're buying a minimum of $80 billion of treasuries per month, $40 billion of mortgage-backed securities. Again, that's the floor, not the ceiling. The Treasury has issued a lot of paper over the past 3 months, so that could be related. So there's so much beyond the surface. But yeah, the easy narrative that if you watch a financial news network for 10 minutes, you're going to get is reflation.
Yeah. And I would add that I believe that there was some talk of actually maybe tapering the purchases. Like, I think there was like a discussion of it. They haven't said they're going to stop the purchases or take them down like explicitly. But I believe I saw some news that they were like considering doing that. And if you look back what happened the last time, like there's a whole thing, the taper tantrum, when they said like, we're going to taper our purchases down, and the market front run that. And so, you know, if the Fed decides or even talks about that, the market can try and like front run those actions. So some of it is anticipation of what, say, the Fed might do.
That's a good point. So going on to John Ahern, here's something about myself. I've been trying to navigate market hubris versus risk. And then he asked about the yields. Do you think that the recent spike in bond yields is a fake out in your view? Do you think that there is a ceiling for bonds before systemic problems start to arise? And if so, where do you feel that ceiling is? And what do you look at as sort of guesstimate where that ceiling is?
I don't have a specific thought on the ceiling. Ed has said that he thinks like 1.5% on the 10-year is kind of like his point of no return. A lot of people smarter than me with more experience in bond markets, George Goncalves being one of them, said like the Fed will try to avoid yield curve control like at all costs, but that will kind of be like the final bullet. And so, you know, that they have, because they really do not want to go negative with rates, but they can implement this yield curve control. And so, you know, I think that there's a decent case for that. You know, I don't know exactly where it is. I think the market will tell us. Like, I think it's pretty clear that the Fed is a reactive organization. And so when yields get too high and the market reacts to yields being too high, that's when the Fed will act. So I don't think it will be the Fed stepping in ahead of time to cap yields before there's a response from the market. And here in the US, generally, that market has been the equity market. So I think that will give you your tell.
Excellent point, Max. My final question comes not from any subscriber, but from me. Max Wheathy, what is your highest conviction trade or highest conviction view at this juncture?
Oh, man.
Put you on the spot.
Okay. So, I mean, I have a few, and I just kind of, like, these are things that I am comfortable holding through any amount of tumult, because I believe the upside is extremely high. I believe the time horizon is long enough to make it through any sort of, you know, major correction or crash. And it's very much like that wall of money, like Flo's argument, who's going to be the next marginal buyer. And so I like cannabis. I think it just, as an industry, just like makes total sense. I think the margins are fantastic on it. And yeah, like institutions can't own it. They cannot own it. There are so many good narratives that can be spun around it. And I think that that makes a lot of sense. I also think that whatever your view on climate change is, it's very clear what the policy is going to be, and people are signing up to hit these green targets. And I don't think it can be done without nuclear. I tend to agree with that. And again, you know, uranium and nuclear energy is not considered part of ESG, like as the flows move to ESG, and maybe there'll be some shift. And you know what? It could just be ignored. It could be the redheaded stepchild of green energy, and nobody will like it. And I could be wrong, but you know, I don't really buy that. I think, you know, markets are inefficient in the short run, but in the long run, you know, the money will find its way. So those are pretty high conviction for me, and I'm comfortable holding positions in those through pretty serious drawdowns.
Very interesting. Just to plug a little bit, I'm scheduling an interview with Lynn Alden, who is pretty bullish on uranium, with a Australian hedge fund manager who invests exclusively in uranium. So it's going to be a peer-to-peer interview. Lynn, you know, most often she's in the interviewee seat, but in this, she's going to be more of an interviewer seat, which should be very interesting. So we should set that up over the next 2 months.
Yeah. And I know I basically do a lot of the booking for Mike Green. Some of the guests are, you know, his friends and connections that he likes to bring in. And I know he wants to talk about that as well. So it'll be something that will be brought up on Real Vision. When consensus happens, and there is a lot of consensus from people who've been on Real Vision about some of these ideas, and you always have to be cautious about risk. And I won't make any recommendations of names or anything like that. That's something that we just can't do as Real Vision, you know, employees and members of the editorial team. We're here to curate great ideas from great minds, from people who can, you know, share their views more freely. And that's really our job. So, you know, I'm willing to tell you what I believe, but I really, you know, want to stress that this is not advice. And everybody, I think where you are in the point in your life, and Raleigh even talks about this with his boomer, you know, like the wealth transfer and like what's coming up as you know, boomers have to sell and change their portfolios. Like what point in time in life you are like really matters. And like I'm 26 years old. I have 95% of my earning potential ahead of me. Like I can take risk. I can take risk that maybe other people shouldn't take. And that's part of the reason I say maybe hurting myself by not being irresponsibly long, because you know, if there's ever a time, it's now. If I get wiped out, I make it back in a few paychecks. Like it's not a big deal. So, you know, that's what I would say about that.
Yeah. All interesting thoughts. Max, this has been an absolute pleasure having you on the RVDB during you sort of asking me anything. I think it's great because it's you and I talking, but it's also the subscribers who supplied the question. So we, you know, the conversation always continues, and I hope we can do this again soon.
Yeah. And like we're both in the exchange. Like if you have other questions, feel free to message me. You know, sort of the caveats I gave, like I will not give you tax advice. I will not talk to you about what your portfolio should be. I will not, you know, give you a take on a name. But if you have questions, like I'm always happy to answer.
Yeah. So Max, what you're saying is that if you know, a user wants to know, like, should I invest in Uniswap or Zcash? You're the guy to talk to. That's what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes. Please DM me with all of your questions about, you know, which altcoin you should invest in. That's exactly, I'm the right guy for that.
Yeah. Obviously, we're joking. Well, Max, thanks so much for joining me. Talk soon.
Yeah. Talk to you soon, Jack.